Welcome to the Woodridge Baptist Church podcast. For more information about what's happening in the life of our church, visit our website at www.woodridge.org. Enjoy the podcast.
We're going to continue our work in Acts and begin Acts chapter 7. Actually, do all of Acts chapter 7. It's a doozy, 60 verses and all. It'll feel like a marathon, but it'll be more like a sprint based on what a high overview we end up actually doing over all this. Even though it may seem like a lot of content, most of the time we're just scratching the surface because of how deep the Bible is. So it's fascinating work. As we've gone through the first six chapters of Acts, we've witnessed the ongoing formation of the new community, with the addition of Stephen recently becoming one of the first deacons. So we're seeing service roles and a structure. Eventually we'll be seeing bishops and related offices being formed here in the early church. And we're kind of seeing also some of the first landmarks or signposts of the early church as it begins to take structure. The speech that we're going to see, you probably see it depending on which version of the Bible you're looking at or which translation, is either Stephen's defense or Stephen's apology. Apology, of course, more like an apologetic, so like a defense. So you've probably seen that at some point. But what he's trying to do here, he's not trying to get off the hook. It's not like some sort of an acquittal that he is searching for, but instead he's trying to defend who this new community is, what this idea that they've not yet named as Christianity, and what that looks like for them and what it's going to look like for the rest of the world eventually, and how it's going to affect the belief of Judah and the more traditional Jews going forward. This is kind of setting up a long, long future of Christians and Jews doing apologists or apologetics to each other, with each other. Probably not two is not the best word, but with each other, and this ongoing debate about who the Messiah is in the Jewish viewpoint and, of course, the Christian viewpoint. And so there's a lot to this. You have to remember that the audience that Stephen is speaking to here is the Sanhedrin. So it's the council made up mainly of Sadducees and Pharisees, two different types of priests. The Sadducees containing the high priest and the more powerful of the group, at least in this case. And their concern, of course, is that their job, their sole role is to defend God and to defend the temple from any sort of heretics or roustabouts that would come their way. And there had been many over the centuries. And so to them, this is just one more person or one more group who are trying to overtake Judaism, trying to destroy the temple once again. And so that you got to think that's their viewpoint that they are coming from as they look at this. It's not like they are looking, though they come across as very mean, because when Luke wrote this, he wasn't a huge fan of the Jews at the time he wrote this, based on the amount of persecution that was going on to this new group. So you have to see that it's written with that sort of bent towards it. And so that is something to always keep in mind as we read through this about who the audience of Stephen is and why they were upset in the first place. Some of them had come to the other side. We see in previous we've seen in previous verses here in Acts where some of the priests had come over. Most likely those were kind of your day-to-day priests. And I believe last week brought up Zechariah as being one of those, as many others. So it was happening. It just was kind of this high guard of priests that were just really pushing hard against this new idea of what this idea of Christianity would be, or people who would follow this Christ. So again, let's keep that in mind as we go forward and read through chapter 7. As we read through here, there's a couple breaks, of course, a couple main sections that Stephen brings up. And again, if Of course, here in verse 7, it starts with the priest asking Stephen a question. And then, of course, the rest is, for the most part, Stephen's response to that until we get to the very end, where we get a little bit more information about what happens to Stephen. So let's read chapter 7, verses 1 through 8. And you'll notice probably some different fonts as you go through this. So keep that in mind as you see it. And see what Stephen is trying to do. And it's you'll see some similarities to what we saw Peter do earlier on in a couple of his early speeches. What we'll see in future texts related to Acts, as well as some other New Testament writings. So here we go. The high priest said, "Are these things so?" And he said, "Hear me, brethren and fathers. The God of glory appeared to our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia, before he lived in Haran, and said to him, 'Leave your country and your relatives and come to that land that I will show you.' They left the land of the Chaldeans and settled in Haran. From there, after his father died, God had him move to this country in which you are now living. But he gave him no inheritance in it, not even a foot of ground, and yet even when he had no child, he promised that he would give it to him as a possession and to his descendants after him. But God spoke to this effect, that his descendants would be aliens in a foreign land, and that they would be enslaved and mistreated for 400 years. In whatever nation to which they will be in bondage, I myself will judge, said God. And after that, they will come out and serve me in this place. And he gave them the covenant of circumcision. And so Abraham became the father of Isaac and circumcised him on the eighth day. And Isaac became the father of Jacob, and Jacob of the 12 patriarchs. So as you can see there, there's a lot of detail. And I would highly recommend that you spend some additional time with everything that Stephen is referencing here, especially the starting of this new people, this new nation that is being formed here. Highly, highly recommend that, because we won't be able to go through all the details of how this played out. If you spend any time in the Old Testament, you'll understand some of what he's talking about, but it'll probably take a little bit deeper depth going into there. The idea of the 400 years and the enslavement, that's all about the diaspora. That's all about the time in which the Jewish people were taken over. Most likely, of course, the Jewish people, the people of Judea, were taken over by the Babylonians, and then in came the Assyrians and the Romans and the Greeks, the Persians, a few other groups along the way, and that was the kind of their 400 years of without hearing anything from God. Again, I would recommend, if you went back to some of our other Bible studies, we did Daniel, and Daniel has a lot of details about how all that played out. So go check that out at some point. So as we go through here, some of the key points that we'll need to keep in mind is that the presence of God is not restricted to the temple. The presence of God is not restricted to a specific people group. It's not to a specific piece of land or a building. And that's something that Peter has talked about. The priests are starting to feel, and Stephen continues to speak about. And we bring this up because long before Abraham entered into a holy land or was standing in anywhere that was considered holy, he was called by God long before any of that happened. And so, again, the point being made that God will call his people wherever they are. There is not a specific holy place here on this earth. It is, and so, just again, but of course the priests thought the temple was the holy place. That was the connection between heaven and earth, and where everyone would come, and that was really the only holy place. Well, the whole idea of Acts up to this point has been that, no, actually, it is outside the temple. The temple is no longer relevant in the way that it used to be. Another example is how the law was given to Moses as Moses wandered in the wilderness and was up on Mount Sinai. They were wandering before the Promised Land was even accessed. So you have to think about that part of it as well, is that we got the law well before the Promised Land was actually given. So they kind of lived off of faith there and lived in that regard. The people of God should not be restricted to one location. Like for the Jewish people, they would think that would be Jerusalem. They could be anywhere in the world. The Jewish people at that time, especially the priests,
they even thought, you remember when this all started, Pentecost was happening, you had a lot of the diaspora, the Hellenistic Greeks, returned to Jerusalem, and they were looked down upon, it seems, based compared to those Jews who remained or were more rooted in Jerusalem. And you also have to remember that just a couple chapters back, actually it was last week, we had the issues with the Hellenistic Jews, widows, and the Hebrew widows, and that effect too. So a lot of history between these two groups at this point. Another thing we have to think about as we read through this, and something that's going to happen here with Stephen, is that the Jewish people had refused most all of God's messengers along the way. You can think about going all the way back to Joseph, to Moses, most all the prophets, Jesus most recently, and now Peter, John, and eventually what we see here with Stephen. It's a pattern. It's not a healthy pattern or a good pattern, but something that had been happening. Without getting too deep in the nuances of what he's trying to say here, there are some who believe that what was going on and how he was kind of going through this was possibly coming from the Ebionites. And the Ebionites were Judaizing Christians who for several centuries separated themselves from Catholic Christians. And they shared a similar view that Stephen has to the temple order and the sacrificial rituals. Of course, to the priest was not a good view. These people looked at the Deuteronomic prophet, like Moses was. We'll see this again in verse 37. The major difference here is that we see, and why we're seeing it play out the way it is and how you can have this comparison, is that the Ebionites' views came after the destruction of the temple, which happened in 70 AD. The speech that Stephen is giving right now is about 40 years before the temple is destroyed. Probably a little less than 40 years, but within that time period. So well before the Ebionites had formed their own opinion about all this, Stephen was coming up with this argument, this defense that he had. Another big difference in what we're seeing here is that the Ebionites were not ones to evangelize Gentiles, while Stephen, of course, and the other Hellenistic Jews were, and they were focused on working with Gentiles. Of course, that is what Paul does, as we'll see later on. So Stephen and the Hellenists better appreciated the universal scope of the gospel, unlike the Ebionites and unlike, of course, the priests. The priests, of course, thought it was just for the Jewish people. The Ebionites maybe expand that a little bit, but not at all at the level that Stephen and his fellow Christian peers were doing. Stephen is reminding the priest as we read through this, and possibly pointing to what is eventually written in Hebrews 13:13, to abandon traditional Judaism and to go forth from outside the confines of the temple. So I'd go check out Hebrews 13:13 to see that. And the idea here is that with what Christ has done and what the Messiah has come and what he has done has changed the world according to what the defense that Stephen is giving. And it was time for everyone to get on board. It wasn't just for these kind of outlier fringe groups. It was for everyone to get on board, especially the priests. A little bit more here. Stephen, of course, as we know, is one of the first deacons to serve in the Jerusalem community. Was full of the Spirit, and obviously the Spirit had come to him even more as he's doing this. And it seems just a little bit more background on him is that since he was a Hellenistic Jew, he probably spent most of his time in Hellenistic synagogues, so more of the Greek-speaking synagogues. Of course, they had the same or similar Jewish traditions and the sacrifices and rituals and everything. But at the same time, and coming to this point where he is and how he even got here, you can imagine there were a lot of strong debates with those who lived in Jerusalem and those who were coming from the outside and what Stephen was trying to bring up at this point. It seems here that these strong debates led him to the same council that we saw if we went back to chapter 5. So we're looking at there and here, and the high priest questions Stephen about what he has been teaching in the synagogues, which leads Stephen, of course, into a speech, or I would like to look at it as kind of more of a story or a historical overview or a historical monologue of what had happened in the past. And, sorry, technical difficulty. And, whoops, lost my point of view. Edit that piece out. And the priests, of course, well, the people who brought them here were probably a mixture of Hellenistic priests, and they'd probably they'd brought them before the council, like I said, that we saw back in chapter 5. And what is happening here, Stephen is being accused about speaking against the temple and the law, the Mosaic law. And so when you start speaking against the temple and the Mosaic law, you're naturally then begin talking about God, or speaking against God, Yahweh. And the idea that saying that Jesus would destroy the temple, Jesus said the same thing, of course, and change the customs given them by Moses, as you can imagine, that's how they lived. That's what that was their day-to-day, Mosaic, following the Mosaic law. And to have someone come in into their council room and say, hey, this is all going to end, and this has all been really bad, and you guys really screwed all this up, you can imagine did not go well. And it gets even worse as he goes through this. So you think this idea of the Mosaic law, the Abrahamic covenant, the temple, everything they did within the temple was full of cultural and religious symbolic significance. And as you know, people do not respond well whenever other people say negative things about their cultural and symbolic religious beliefs. And even though a lot of us like to say we're not religiously believers, or I'm sorry, not cultural believers, we are to a point. We all are influenced by our culture and the way we grew up and our worldview at some point and in some way. And there is going to be something that someone says to us about what we think we believe that is going to offend us. Probably not at the level that it offended these priests, but at the same point, it's going to be offensive, and you can imagine what that would look like. Stephen's next, what we see through these first several verses is not what we see with Peter regarding the resurrection and the work of Jesus here on earth and how they killed the Messiah. Stephen goes back way to the very beginning when their religion had started, and he is showing them the path that the religion took and how they should see the path from the very beginning, to see that they have been in kind of a ongoing rhythm that has led them into a lot of deep, dark paths and places where them as a people would not go or should not have gone. It leads them into many bad areas, and they have make a lot of mistakes, and they're heading into that direction again, if not already in it. And the idea that Stephen is trying to give here, if they follow the path as God had intended them to do, they would see where they were in history and the significance of this moment, if they choose to do so. Otherwise, they're going to try to stone Stephen, they do, right? I think you've all read that before. They seem, of course, not to choose the option of, oh my gosh, the Messiah has come. Oh my gosh, everything that the prophets had said has come to fruition. But they don't see it, and it's just amazing how that is. And like we see in Daniel 9 and Nehemiah 9 and Psalm 105 and 106, they're getting the full story. Stephen is continuing the traditions of the path, but it seems the priests do not see this. Stephen is giving them everything that they've done. I mean, it's amazing that they don't see it, and I just find that to be fascinating. What is great about what Stephen is saying, as well as what we see in some of the prophets, all kinds of internet issues today, sorry. And what we see happening, of course, there. So let's look a little bit at verse 2. We're going to kind of jump back and forth here, and I've kind of gone over everything, and now we're going to come back and kind of bring up some of this here and there as we go forward. But he starts with the God of glory as we look at this, and he has done this before. We've heard this before. And then he moves the earthly patriarchs of their faith, and then all the people that they would be familiar with. The only other time we see God of glory is in Psalm 29:3. He is doing this to show that he is starting with the same God that they believe in, that is not a new God that he is telling them about. It's not like, okay, this other God that we found, or this Jesus came from another God, or this Jesus was another God that we talk about. It's like, no, this God that you guys know of, the God of glory, the one, very one that you worship every day, is doing this, and this is where we are. Regarding Abraham, is where it all begins with their religion. So that's in Mesopotamia, far from where the promised land would be. And it is this part of Genesis where God begins the story of where the world will begin to be set right. So where the redemption of the world will happen begins with Abraham. And if you look through Abraham's story, some would even say that him sacrifice or attempted sacrifice of Isaac was pointing to the sacrifice, the eventual sacrifice of Jesus, and how God would sacrifice his son, and how Abraham is doing that, and the symbolism tied to that. Some people take that as true, and some people don't. Take it as you will. But there is some very interesting similarities. But what it ultimately does is that it shows Abraham's faith as he embarks on a journey. He did not have to go on this journey. But yet God, what God said to him was so compelling that he decides to go on this journey. It wasn't like God came to Abraham and said, if you don't go, I'm going to kill you. Or if you don't go, I'm going to destroy your family. And God could have, I guess, but that wasn't the point. The point was for Abraham to walk in faith, to go in faith. And their religion, their way they live, what the priests believe, started with faith. And it seems they've lost some of that. And it's also tied a lot, of course, to obedience. And will they hold on tightly to what their spiritual culture has become, or will they hold on tightly to their obedience and faith in God? Calling out Abraham and beginning this new nation is how God is going to eventually, like I said, redeem all creation. So Abraham is called, or Abram at the time, is called out of from the Chaldeans, also known as Mesopotamia, and settled in Haran, which is in the upper Euphrates Valley. And it's an intersection of very important caravan trade routes during that time period. And it was one of the probably the most, I don't know, more flourishing areas in about the second millennium BC, so about 2000 BC. Once his father dies, or Abram's father dies, after they've lived in this place for a while, there is some divine guidance that's provided to him, and he makes his way to Canaan. But he never entered or possessed any land. He just lived in the trust on the promise of God for his future ancestors. And so that's a very good view of faith. So how God will deal with human sin, social catastrophe, and cosmic disaster of what all is being dealt with here, and all that we learn about from Genesis 3 to 11 is how all this is starting to play out. The next couple of verses here, Abraham was called out for a specific purpose, to leave the home of his ancestors, to set him apart, giving him a new vocation. Stephen is not denying that this happened. He's insisting that this happened, and it is the beginning of the path of where they are today. So that is what the priest should do. They should go all the way back to Abraham and then follow the path all the way back to where they are today. And they, of course, decide not to do that. Stephen focuses on Genesis 15. Paul does the same in Galatians 3. The way of the people of God, the Abrahamic covenant, that they will be enslaved by a foreign nation, but will be brought out and given a land of inheritance. Stephen begins to point to the Exodus led by Moses, which is the next half of this chapter. The Exodus, as we know, along with Abraham and God's covenant, is a central pillar to all of the Jewish faith. Stephen is also pointing very sharply at the temple, which, as we know from previous chapters, is no longer the center of the faith, or at least of this new community of faith. So the Jewish priests, of course, continued to use the temple as they had been, but that was not that was not how it should have been, and they forgot to see that. All right, let's look at verse 9 and start running through those. 9 through 16. And some of this is going to happen pretty quick just because we're able to jump through it relatively quickly here because of some of the stuff that he says. So chapter 7, verse 9. The patriarchs became jealous of Joseph and sold him into Egypt, yet God was with him. So we're all familiar with Joseph and the coat of many colors that his father gave him, and his brothers, who eventually became the tribes of Israel, shipped him off or sold him, and he eventually becomes the leader of Egypt under Pharaoh, and rescued him from all the afflictions and granted him favor and wisdom in the sight of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he made him governor over Egypt and all his household. Now a famine came over all Egypt and Canaan, and great affliction with it, and our fathers could find no food. But when Jacob heard that there was grain in Egypt, he sent our fathers there the first time. Of course, the fathers being the tribes of Egypt, tribes of Israel. On the second visit, Joseph made himself known to his brothers, and Joseph's family was disclosed to Pharaoh. Then Joseph sent word and invited Jacob, his father, and all his relatives to come to him, 75 persons in all. It's an interesting stat. And Jacob went down to Egypt, and there he and our fathers died. From there they were removed to Shechem and laid in the tomb which Abraham had purchased for the sum of money from the sons of Hamor in Shechem. So you get a lot of history. You get the time of Joseph and what he did, and we, of course, if you were to turn back into the Old Testament, you'd be able to see the full story of Joseph, or at least what we know of it, and to be able to see an understanding about how this is all tied together. So we get a retelling of the story of the patriarchs and their mistreatment of Joseph. So God, as he likes to do, uses this mistreatment for a way for Joseph to get to Egypt and to rule over much of Egypt, and eventually to help the 12 patriarchs, some people call them patriarchs. Let's just refer to them as the 12 tribes of Israel, to help Israel continue as a nation. So he uses something bad to advance his initiative or his goal or his kingdom, probably a better way. And that is something that we can find a lot of solace in, because God continues to do that to this day. With the famine, the patriarchs unknowingly come to Joseph and they ask for relief, and eventually learn that it is very much their brother that they have betrayed, that they have come to see. But before we move on into the next part of this chapter here, we have to look at the significance of a story like this to reflect on what we think we know or believe, and take another look at the story to help us be better guided and see additional truth that we did not see in the past. Stephen, with the help of the Holy Spirit, is revealing or re-revealing, providing God's revelation to much of what it seems the priests have forgotten. It seems like they've gotten so caught up with their day-to-day that they have forgotten where they had come from, where their belief, their faith had come from, and how they had gotten to this point. So it's just fascinating to see how all that plays out for him and plays out for the rest of the people that are hearing this. And I just find that to be very similar to what we see today, is that a lot of times we forget where we've come from. We forget what we believe because we get caught up in petty arguments and things that really don't matter or don't advance the kingdom. There are so many things, so many distractions that we deal with day to day, both here in the church and outside the church, members and everyone else, that really keeps us from advancing the kingdom of God. And so God's kingdom is going to continue to be where he wants it to be and go, but we would want to be a part of that. And that's what Stephen is trying to tell these priests, is that you guys need to be a part of this, not pushing against it, but going with it and being part of what this new community is. It's not a new religion, because it's just a continuation of Judaism. Let's see here. Let's look at 17 through 29, verses 29. Like I said, we'll be moving quickly through some of this, just because of everything that happened here. And if you're curious about some more of the story of Joseph and Jacob, and who eventually became known as Israel, and the 12 tribes, and how those formed, and the back and forth, and the host you know, holding Benjamin hostage and all that sort of fun stuff that happened during that time. I encourage you to go back and read that in the Old Testament. So anyways, verse 17 of chapter 7. But as the time of the promise was approaching, which God had assured to Abraham, the people increased and multiplied in Egypt until there arose another king over Egypt who knew nothing about Joseph. It was he who took shrewd advantage of our race and mistreated our fathers so that they would be exposed, their infants, and they would not survive. It was at this time that Moses was born. So we start with Abraham, we go to Joseph and Jacob, and now we go to Moses. Verse 19, it was he who took shrewd advantage of our race and mistreated our fathers so that they would expose their infants and that they would not survive. It was at this time that Moses was born, and he was lovely in the sight of God, and he was nurtured 3 months in his father's home. And after he had been set outside, Pharaoh's daughter took him away and nurtured him as her own son. Moses was educated in all the learning of the Egyptians, and he was a man of power in words and deeds. So what are we seeing here, like we saw with Joseph? We saw that man had tried to do something bad, and God was using it for good to further his kingdom here. Verse 23, but when he was approaching this age of 40, it entered his mind to visit his brethren, the sons of Israel. And when he saw one of them being treated unjustly, he defended him and took vengeance for the oppressed by the striking down the Egyptian. And he supposed that his brethren understood that God was granting them deliverance through him, but they did not understand. On the following day, he appeared to them as they were fighting together, and he tried to reconcile them in peace, saying, men, you are brethren, why do you injure one another? But the one who was injuring his neighbor pushed him away, saying, who made you a ruler and judge over us? You do not mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian yesterday, do you? At this remark, Moses fled and became an alien in the land of Midian, where he became the father of two sons. Again, a good, quick overview of the beginnings of the life of Moses. We'll continue with Moses here in a second, but now we get kind of the early, let's just say the first 40 years of Moses' life. Then we'll get another 40 years and another 40 years, and it all works out the way it does. And so as we see here, we see the growth. So obviously, the people who are known as Israel now has grown in Egypt and has really started to be a dominating population, which has made the Pharaoh, of course, very nervous. The same Pharaoh who the Pharaoh did not know who Joseph was. He did not know the history of this people. And if he did, he did not trust them or like them that much. And so he, of course, wanted to remove them from the world and to use them as slaves to help further his own building and desires. And, of course, the larger the Egyptian people, I'm sorry, the Jewish people became, the more oppression that came upon them. So Moses here emerges as a new leader who goes on as one exile until called back by God. So he goes to Midian on his own exile to kind of learn who he is. Spends about, if I remember right, 40 years in exile before he returns back to Israel, back to Egypt. So that had to be just a very interesting time where the people were already in pretty bad shape before he left. And I think it seemed like it just got more and more harder on them and more oppressive as they continued to live underneath Egyptian oppression. So, but I guess it took 40 years for Moses to be able to do this. There's 40 is used several times throughout the Bible. I would recommend that you look into why that is, because there is just a little bit of significance tied to this. We see through this story the pillars of a nation being established, where histories are being written and stories will be told for the rest of the time of this nation. So what is being created here through the time of Abraham to Joseph into the time of Moses are the traditions and the religions and the way to live as a Jewish person. So if you read the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, and you see how all this is starting to play out, you'll see why there are certain things that were being created for in ways of how people should live and how they should respond to other people and how they should treat their neighbors and how they should worship God and everything through this. We could compare this kind of this growth or this building where major events happen, kind of like for us, we had the founding of our country, the establishment of the Constitution, where we were freed from an oppressive regime, which at that time was Britain. And then eventually we had the Civil War, which of course was extremely divisive and continues to see the effects of that to this day, and how the nation treats its people. In Israel and most any other nations, if you go back and look at their history, there's a similar pattern that is formed. So Moses, as we know, is the key figure in all of the history of Israel, for it was him who received the law or the Torah from God, and we know that to be the foundation on which all of Israel is founded to determine how it could go forward. So it was pretty much the guiding principles of what it was to be a Jewish person. The Mosaic Law, as it is known, has been interpreted in many different ways, and as we know from some of the teachings of the Sadducees and the Pharisees, but what they agreed on, it was a foundation. So the Sadducees and the Pharisees did not agree on everything in the Mosaic Law, at least not in the same way. They interpreted it differently, which is odd, right? Because no church or religious group, you know, if you look at Protestants to Catholics or Methodists to Baptist, you name it. It's different. It's interpreted just a little bit differently, and that's similar to what the Pharisees and the Sadducees were doing. But ultimately, what they agreed on, and much like most of us, is that they agree on the basics and the basic foundations. Everything believed of who Jesus was. So let's use that as our basic foundation: Jesus, the Savior and Messiah of the world. It doesn't seem like there's any disagreement about that. So in their view, the Pharisees and the Sadducees' view, the law was God's will and was not to be changed or altered in any way, and they felt like that's what Stephen and his crew were trying to do. Remember that the eyewitnesses that brought Stephen to this court had claimed that Stephen was speaking against Moses. So Stephen brings up 3 points to counter this argument, because he wasn't speaking against Moses. He was providing some context about what was going on and how they had ended up to this point. So Moses was raised up in a way that he was the perfect leader for God's people. He was raised in Pharaoh's home to learn the way of the Egyptians, an educational system that was legendary, and you know, prepared Moses to do what he needed to do in the future. Much like many other people who were called up by God, Moses, who was supposed to rescue the people, was rejected by his own people. But then again, the first 40 years was not his time to rescue the people. So he is rejected, goes in exile, and then returns to help guide the people. So Moses is the one who's called to reveal God to the Jewish people in a fresh way, to let them see who this God is that they worshipped and probably not are worshiping quite as they used to. Probably brought in a There's a lot of evidence that they brought in a lot of Egyptian practices, a lot of pagan practices to that. I think his point to that was that God, the God they know is the same God he is talking about. That's what Stephen, again, is trying to say to these priests. We're talking about the same God here. The God they came to know through Jesus is not different God that came to be known for their ancestors. it all happens where the earth will never be the same again. That's when Jesus came. And Abraham started it, pointing to this point right here. We have it the same way. I guess another turning point would be with Moses and the burning bush, where he comes out of exile and he goes to go lead the people, where you see the burning bush, where heaven and earth, much like in a temple, in the temple, heaven and earth come together and create holy ground. Through this connection of heaven and earth, Moses is given a vision that will change the lives of all the people going forward for the better. And that is what they need to see, but yet are not seeing it. So that's why it's so crazy. As we can see, nothing that is said by Stephen is disparaging against Moses in any way. Moses was called and prepared by God to do the work of God, and that's what Stephen is trying to say. Like I just mentioned, but just as a kind of a overview here, the first holy ground was most likely the burning bush. The temple, compared to the temple, also holy ground because it was where God would reveal himself until the death and resurrection of Jesus. And then at that point, It was not what it used to be. It had changed forever at that point. So again, we see that Stephen is speaking no ill against Moses, but he is same time saying that the temple has seen its time, and now Jesus supersedes the holy authority of the temple. The temple no longer has the holy authority that it once did. It's mainly symbolic and traditions at this point, based on how Jesus superseded it. They're getting a new revelation from Stephen to see their religion in a new light with the light of Jesus. Much like us, they can choose to see how God is revealing himself or not. And at this point, they choose not to. And I hope we do not choose to do the same. I hope that we are keeping our eyes and our hearts open to see how Jesus, what Jesus has done for us and what God is trying to reveal to us, and so that we do not grow blind to the work of God here around us. Let's see here, verses 35 through, holy moly, let's see here, 43. This Moses whom they disowned, saying, "Who made you ruler and judge?" is the one whom God sent to be both ruler and deliverer with the help of the angel who appeared to him in the thorn bush. So, this man led them out, performing wonders and signs in the land of Egypt, in the Red Sea, and in the wilderness for 40 years. This is the Moses who said to the son of Israel, "God will raise up for you a prophet like me from your brethren." This is the one who is in the congregation in the wilderness together with the angel, and who is speaking to him on Mount Sinai, and who is with our fathers, and he received living oracles to pass on to you. Our fathers were unwilling to be obedient to him and repudiated him, and in their hearts turned back to Egypt, saying to Aaron, "Make for us gods who will go before us, for this Moses who led us out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what happened to him." If you remember, Moses went up to Mount Sinai and disappeared for a while. He knew where he was, and God knew where he was, but people didn't know where he was. And so they're like, "What the heck? Let's keep on moving." And this Moses guy, he just disappeared on us. At that time, they made a calf and brought a sacrifice to the idol and were rejoicing in the works of their hands. But God turned away and delivered them up to serve the host of heaven, as it is written in the book of prophets, "It was not to me that you offered victims and sacrifices 40 years in the wilderness. Was it, O house of Israel? You also took along the tabernacle of Moloch and the star of the god Rampha, the images which you made to worship. I also will remove you beyond Babylon." It's getting better every minute. So the story of Moses continues. The story of the wandering in the wilderness continues, and it will continue as we go into the next section here. But we see a lot of just highlights that I imagine that you're probably pretty familiar with the making of the golden calf and Moses going up to Mount Sinai and getting the law and the wandering in the wilderness and them continuing to turn when God tells them not to, the people continue to turn to the nations that they were to defeat, and so that continues to happen through this. So here we go. As we look at here, they turn to things made from hand, which today is something we enjoy. As in it for us today, it's like took an authentic work of art or a creative piece. During the time of Moses, it was a bad thing to have something made from hand. At least in this context, was everything was made by hand back then. But the issue is, right, is that they worshipped it. They made it with their own hands, and they worshipped it, which is why this is a problem. If they would make it with their own hands, like a cup, or if they would have made the calf and not worshipped it. I mean, we all have little figurines around our house, and they probably did too at some level capacity that we're not familiar with. But it's different. So they had turned their, they've disobeyed God. They've put their faith in things made from the hands of man. Follow along with this, because this is what's leading to why the temple is not important anymore either. So they had this primal sin of idolatry through this worshiping, as if this golden calf and these other things that they were worshiping was a god. They had been warned not to do this by the prophets and other biblical writers. The prophet, again, pointing to the future, to how Jerusalem or the people of Jerusalem continue to, as you hear some of the prophets say, whore after pagan gods. They create them and worship him, and that is not good. Verse 41. Stephen is declaring that all of Israel has drunk in the wickedness of the two cows. The one that Aaron made, so he's referencing two things. He's referencing the one that's made by Aaron in Exodus 32, the calves that Jeroboam made for the northern tribes as an alternative shrine to Jerusalem in 1 Kings 12. You remember that was about the time period Israel and Judea had split, and Jerusalem had the big temple in it, and Israel did not, and so they would try other things, and that did not work for them, and of course they were wiped out well before the people of Judea were wiped out. So he brings this up because the pattern has been created. There's this pattern of worshiping idols. And no matter how devout the people of Israel seemed, the possibility of idolatry was not too far away. And again, the same could be said for our own temptations and tendencies today to disobey God in the way we do. For many of us, a very, if not most all of us, a regular, very regular basis. And so this pattern, again, is pointing to how the priests are responding to what Stephen is saying here. In the next couple verses, 42 and 43, we get a quote from Amos chapter 5, and that even during the years in the wilderness when God had set up the sacrificial system, they knew what they were supposed to do. They'd been provided the directions of how to sacrifice to God, how to live holy lives, how to be separate people from the rest of the world, which is what they were to be, is separated, which is why they had all these rules, laws, sacrificial system that they were given to them. The people continue to worship pagan gods. The hosts of heaven, they would do. And the astral deities that are mentioned there in verse 43, is that right? Yep. Moloch and Raphim. They were, when the people of Israel saw it as a good time with God, was actually rebellion, idolatry, instead of true worship. That is something that is happening here that he is pointing out to them, is that instead of them fully and truly worshiping one and only God, they were worshiping God, but they were throwing in these other idols as well, these other gods, these other gods that they hoped would help them along the way. That they hoped, because they did not think God was sufficient, and so they would do that. And it's the same for us, is that many times we rely on other things, and that's why we have to be careful, is that we rely on God and knowing God will provide, and the obedience that we have in God. Let's see here. And just like they had rejected God with rebellion, this generation has chosen to rebel against God by rejecting their deliverer. So this group, these priests, have rejected God once again. They rebelled against God by rejecting who Jesus was. It's not Stephen who is the heretic, but to be honest, it's the priests who are the heretics. He is not blaspheming the true God and the temple. They are. The ruling class, they are following the same pattern as all the other people before them, and they cannot see that they are doing that. And so though they are calling Stephen a heretic, it is not he who is, it is they who are. All right, 44 through 53, it gets pretty heated, if you didn't think it was already, as we go through this next section here before Stephen meets his final call. Verse 44, chapter 7. Our fathers had the tabernacle of testimony in the wilderness, just as he spoke to Moses, directed him to make it according to the pattern which he had seen. And having received it in their turn, our fathers brought it in with Joshua upon dispossessing the nations whom God drove out before our fathers until the time of David. Now we're to David. So we started with Abraham, we went to Joseph, went to Moses, went to Aaron for a little bit. He doesn't really count. And now we're with David. David found favor in God's sight and asked that he might find a dwelling place for the God of Jacob. Why is David significant? So lineage of Jesus is being formed at this point. However, the Most High does not dwell in houses made by human hands. Oh, I believe David was told that. As the prophet says, heaven is my throne and earth is the footstool of my feet. What kind of house will you build for me, says the Lord? Or what place is there for my repose? Was it not my hand which made all these things? Oh, and then this is where it gets crazy. This is where it gets ugly. If you thought it was, like I said, if you thought it was hot before this. You men who are stiff-necked and uncircumcised, and the heart and ears are always resisting the Holy Spirit, you are doing just as your fathers did. Which one of the prophets did your fathers not persecute? They killed those who had previously announced the coming of the righteous one, that's Jesus, or the Messiah, whose betrayers and murderers you have now become. You have received the law as ordained by angels and yet did not keep it. It's kind of the final blow at that point, because they very quickly began gnashing or grinding their teeth, as we know in the next few verses. So before we get there, we know that David had planned the temple and Solomon had eventually built it. We need to pay close attention to this. If you'd reference Isaiah 66, 1 and 2, the prophet declared, which is in line with what Solomon said in his prayer of dedication in 1 Kings 8:27, that it is God who makes all things. Humans cannot create a handmade building that contains God. To think that is blasphemous, right? So the temple was allowed to be built as a, you could call it a symbol or a place to meet, much like a church is today. But to think that it could contain the God of the universe was just wrong, and to be honest, was blasphemous. It's just not possible. And that is where we're seeing a lot of the rub with our priest friends, because they're thinking, yeah, this is it. This is the ultimate place in which we exist here on this holy land, is where heaven and earth is, and this is where God is, and we're in control and in charge of this. So in one speech, Stephen has overturned all of the Jewish temple theology. God does not live in shrines. Just like, you know, God is everywhere. God has created the universe. He is within and with and out of the universe. He is everywhere. And so you cannot contain him nor hope to, much like our ESPN friends. So heaven is ultimately where the Lord presides. The entire cosmos cannot contain God, since he made it all in the first place. What you make, you cannot be contained in, I guess, is one way to look at that. From the idols that are made from hand, he points to the temple and how it has become an idol, not a holy place for God. It's much like many of our buildings today, our church buildings, sanctuaries, worship centers have become idols for us and how we treat them. It seems like sometimes those are more important than the God that we are worshiping. And that is something we always have to keep in mind, and something the friends in the temple were doing. So they have to put the temple ahead of God, and at the same time, of course, not reject Jesus, which they already did. They're out of line. To be honest, if you really looked at the history of the Jewish faith, starting with Abraham, they are out of line with their own teaching and tradition. They are the children of Abraham, but are not obeying the teachings of Abraham. They are the ancestors of Moses, but are not keeping the law that was given by Moses. Instead, they are killing prophets. They're killing the righteous one, and all the people that were sent to them by God to help them along, they have killed at some point. Like I said, verse 51, it gets a little heated. Stephen quickly here leaves the historical context or the overview that he's been talking to and starts going after the more current situation in which they are in at this point. That does not ultimately bode well for him. But based on how this all started, I think this is where he expected it to all go when it was all said and done. So think about this. God wanted, verse 52, God wanted to be with his people in an incarnation through the being of Jesus to rescue his people. But the Jewish leaders followed the path of their ancestors, the same patterns as their ancestors, and would rather live in their handmade systems and buildings instead of understanding that the Messiah had come. When Stephen reveals from what we know from the prophets and Moses, the people who were supposed to be the people of salvation continue to rebel against God. And these were the priests. The priest, if you go back and read a lot of the Old Testament, the priests and the other leaders of the Jewish faith weren't always on the right track. Many times, I'd say, many of the stories in the Old Testament is where the priests are wrong or misleading the people. Even the kings and even some of the judges are doing the same thing. We should consider the same thing regarding our own traditions and religions. We were creating our own idols and putting God to the side. It's very similar to what the people of the priests were doing during this time. All right, wrap this bad boy up. Chapter 7, verse 54 through 60, where we will see the end of Stephen. He has just crossed the line. He has gone too far, and it is time for him. So what has turned into a trial or a meeting in front of the council has now turned into a lynch mob. Verse 54. Now when they heard this, they were cut to the quick and they began gnashing their teeth at him. Others say grinding. I think that's fabulous. Grinding. You can imagine. They're really upset. Where is that? Yeah, ground their teeth at him. So these things became furious and ground their teeth at him. Oh, ground to the quick. And anyways, but being full of the Holy Spirit, he gazed intently into heaven and saw the glory of God and Jesus standing at the right hand of God. And he said, "Behold, I see the heavens opened up and the Son of Man standing at the right hand of God." But they cried out with a loud voice and covered their ears and rushed at him with one impulse. What's this one say? I forgot what this one said. Oh, they rushed at him with one intent. Oh, I like that. But they covered their ears, shouting out with a loud voice, as in one, as in this large, now single being, and rushed at him with intent. Let's just finish with this. When they had driven him out of the city, they began to stone him, and the witnesses laid their cloaks at the feet of a young man named Saul. They continued to stone Stephen while he prayed, "Lord Jesus, receive my spirit." Then he fell to his knees and cried out with a loud voice, "Lord, do not hold this sin against them." Have we heard this before? Yes. And when he had said this, he died, and Saul agreed completely with killing him. So Saul, if you remember, is a Pharisee. Pharisees of all Pharisees, the Hebrew of Hebrews, is there. Eventually, Paul. We will really start getting to learn a whole lot about him here in pretty quick near future here. So pretty interesting to see how this plays out. So it's pretty dark. We're getting pretty dark in the early church. Stephen, there probably were others who were stoned for this, but we know specifically Stephen, this happening to Stephen. He becomes a martyr. Someone who gives evidence. He has given the truth of who God is, and he has realized that it is worth more than his own life. So that is a martyr for you, and that is what Stephen has become. The statement that Stephen states makes the leaders very angry. It is so offensive what Stephen has said to them. It seems as if he has a vision, which he does here in a second, but like I said, it is turned into a lynch mob. Which is something, to be honest, the Jewish priests had no right to kill anyone. That was, as my understanding, Stephen being a Roman citizen, is only the Romans who could sentence someone to death. Again, go back to Jesus and what happened there. And then other cases as well, what we eventually learn with Paul, he goes all the way to Caesar because he's a Roman citizen. So really had no rights to do that. And The vision that he has here, and based on the context and some of the text here, is not a literal door opening to heaven, but instead he can see clearly what God is trying to teach and teach. Maybe you could see it as the coming together of heaven and earth, kind of like what was in the temple, the new redemption that happens with the resurrection of Jesus, the new beginning. So you can also look at it as kind of what we see in time to kind of give you a few more perspectives. 2 Kings chapter 6, verse 17. When Elisha sees the horse and chariots of fire surrounding him, his eyes are opened to another dimension that is around him that we do not normally see, which I believe that happens a lot in the spiritual realm. We can go even further into Daniel 7 when the Ancient of Days stands before Daniel. The court of God is superseding the court of the priests, is what we see here. So we are in the... has he been ran out of town yet? No, he hasn't been ran out of town yet. So what we're seeing here is that the court of God has superseded the court of the Sanhedrin. These guys who are supposed to be the Jewish leaders and the Jewish priests are being superseded. They may be able to condemn Stephen to a physical death, but the heavenly court, of course, what we see is they find favor in Stephen. The temple was supposed to be the place where heaven and earth join, but we're seeing here that those who are followers of Jesus, that is where heaven and earth come together, which I believe is part of this, the redemption of earth that, like I said, started with the resurrection. We are seeing here also a dimension that many of us will not see, the ability to see heaven and earth at the same time. At least at this point in our current life, not able to see, maybe once we pass on, there will be that ability to exist in that, or I'm not sure how that's going to work out. But it's interesting to think about what he is able to see here. This is not the first time that a Jew is a martyr. I mean, he's still a Jew at the end of the day. Throughout Jewish history, there's been evidence of martyrdom, where the Jewish people were asked to renounce their faith. Just like that's for the most part what is happening here. Stephen is being asked to renounce his faith in the Messiah, and he can't do that. And one example is, just because I'm dying, I know you're dying to know some history for for your next dinner party. There's a pagan king from Syria who, about 200 years before the time of Jesus, wanted the Jewish people to turn from their beliefs, so that they'd be easier to manage. And that a lot of the kings who took over Judah would want to do that. That's what Nebuchadnezzar tries to do in when Babylon takes out Judah with Daniel and the rest of the gang. They're trying to get them to change their beliefs, their religious views, because they believe that if they come to their side of beliefs on religion and spirituality, they'd be easier to manage. If you were to ever have the desire to turn to 2 Maccabees 7, you'd see a good example of this. As they are stoning Stephen, of course, he prays to God to not hold this against him, much like we see with what Jesus does, and then eventually he fell asleep. So you can imagine, sometimes when we think of stoning, we think of just maybe rocks that you can throw, like a baseball size. Most likely, based on some of the stuff I've seen, they were huge. I mean, two-handed, lobbing them hard or dropping them from above. It wasn't just throwing rocks and pebbles at somebody. It was large stuff. So, very, very dark time. But from dark, light comes, and we'll learn that as we continue to proceed through the next couple sections of Acts, where we'll see the light coming out of the darkness. So though Saul will persecute in the church in chapter 8, we'll see that eventually he does come to know who Jesus is. So next week we will begin chapter 8. Probably we'll do all of chapter 8, maybe jump into the conversion of Saul in chapter 9, depending on how much time we have. And then go from there. Thank you. Have a good week.
We hope you have enjoyed the podcast. For more information about our church, visit www.woodridge.org.